Blog Talk Radio.
Sometimes your eyes look blue to me, although I know they're really green. I seem to see you differently.
Gemini, different coin, different size, yeah. Still, I learn to improvise. All my love intensifies. She can see the Gemini, and on the flip side, that's the Jim and her. Way before that was him and her. I can see the him and her. Before the love, I mean, before the friends of Kirby's and birds and all that other shit. Before the time we spent spending time and shit, partaking lovey dovey shit. She shot and buried all lovey Smith. Kissing, hugging, feeling, touching shit. Infatuated with it, fascinated with no knowledge of what we up against. But that's the risk we take, falling in line, not knowing if someone to catch you. It's a leap of faith, I mean, Jesus' sake, baby, it's no doubt that you special. Someone I spent my life next to. You set me straight and I correct you. First you love me not, and then you love me. You someone I always give my best to. Yeah, and respect you.
Wait a minute. Who are you?
Gemini,
different coin, different size, no. Similar shape, similar size, no. Similar smile, similar eyes. Got me looking at a deja vu, I mean, ain't I you, I mean, fuck this shit. Breaking up and then making up and then waking up like enough of this. It's a paradox of paradise. Life's a gamble, here's a paradise. But it's quite the interesting relationship between a host and parasite. Tunnel vision, I prepare my sight for the things I want to grind for. Then I open up my mind for it. Petty shit don't have the time for it. This is shit they get in line for. I just try to make the best of it. All the girls in the world, it is fate in the back, you're the one I connected with. And I put you on a pedestal. Spend the rest of life next to you. You keep me straight and I'm correcting you. A testament to my respect for you.
Tuned in to GEI Radio Sunday Talk. I am your host, Jones. I got my co-host with me. John, what's going on?
What's going on, everybody? How's it is today?
Good, man, good. Just waiting on K-Nell to jump on. How was your weekend?
Oh, that's good. My weekend is good. I heard somebody had a birthday yesterday.
Yeah, man. Dope. It was a dope. It was a dope. Big shout out to you, you know, the wife, Pat, my sister Tyra, and everybody else that helped out with the surprise yesterday. I was definitely shocked. Just real quick, until we get K-Nels on. one of my homeboys had kind of almost gave it up, right?
Lavish.
So I was kind of thinking that it was something else. So I kind of, like, when we got to the studio, I'm like, all right, I don't see no cars. They probably have run the back. She's going to walk me in. They're going to say surprise. So that's what I was waiting on. So we sit in the parking lot for like 30 minutes. So after like a while, it's like, okay, they might not be in there. You know what I'm saying? But then still,
yeah.
I'm like, oh, I'm waiting. So then she was like, all right, get out the car. Like, get out. But I wasn't looking to my right. When I looked, I just seen everybody coming in, pulling in, honking the horns. I'm like, oh, they got me. They got me. They got me good.
Yeah, dope. Your wife set it all up, man. Do a whole parade in your honor, bro. I just wish I could have been there,
yeah.
Man. I'm so disappointed that I wasn't able to make it down for it, but you know my heart was with you.
Yeah, definitely, definitely, man. She, you know, a couple people, you know, she told me, you know, couldn't make it, but it's all good. I mean, we all, this is the time that we're in is one of those things where, you know, you got to be creative. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, the way that we usually party and the way that we usually move and do things, we can't do it like that just yet. So it's not easy for people leaving the state. So, you know, some of us are taking care of parents. Some of us got kids, you know. So you want to make sure everything right and everything's safe. So it's all good, man. We definitely, it definitely was a good time.
So how do you feel to hit that number, man?
I don't know, man. The only birthday that really I felt like a change, like where I felt the number change, was 21.
Yeah.
That was the only number that was like, I felt it. Like, okay, I'm really an adult now. You know what I'm saying? Like all of us, like the 25, the 30, the 35, the 40. I mean, I'm blessed to make it. I'm definitely blessed to be able to be here for, you know, on this earth for 40 years. But the 21 was the one that hit me. That was the one that was like, yo, I'm 21. Like, I ain't gotta get no more fake IDs. I ain't gotta pay extra money at the club. You know what I'm saying? I can just go in. You know what I'm saying? Oh, we got K-Nails with us.
Yeah,
K-Nails,
yeah.
What's going on?
What it do?
What else?
Man, I'm cooler, man. Just been doing a lot of running around today, just taking care of a few things. So, you know, I'm fashionably late, but everything is well.
That's what I was asking Tone about that surprise birthday he had yesterday.
I know he old man status, baby.
Yeah, <it's dangerous. laughs> You know what? Let me ask y'all, what was the number? What was the age that you felt the number? Like, what from Nails on the, what you 30?
Yeah.
Jonathan 50, I'm 40. So it's 30, 40, and 50. But what number was it where you was like, okay, I feel the change?
Yo, for me, believe it or not, it was 25. The change wasn't a physical one. But when I turned 25, everything started looking different. I couldn't process, like, the way I processed everything was different. And so it was all, I call it, I dubbed it the quarter-life crisis. When I turned 25, I realized, like, that's a very pivotal, you know, everybody's like 30, yeah, I get it. In understanding time, I try to control how much I let time control the way I think about things. But I know in that, I always say between 25 and 30, that was a very, you know, transformative period for me because it forced me to refine this idea of who I thought I was. And so, you know, 25 really hit different for me because it's like, yeah, you know, you've formulated a lot of opinions and ideas and you have this concept of who you are, but you'll realize as you continue to learn and grow, how much of that, those ideas was misplaced or underdeveloped. So I spent 25 to 30 really refining all of these different ideas of who I thought I was and the things that I thought about, what I put my ambitions in and belief systems and all of that. So 25, up until this point, I say 25 was that time period where it was, I was like, man, what is going on? It was where, in hindsight, it's 2020, so I could look back and say that clearly, but while I was in it, I just knew I felt different. My outlook on life was different.
Mm-hmm. What was yours, Jonathan?
Definitely feel you on that. It was 31, because I became a father. And my idea of who I am and what I have to be changed forever, because now I'm caring for a life and I have the responsibility of raising a black queen. It changed how I look at the black woman. It changed, you know, my focus, where, you know, your focus is now on someone else other than yourself. I mean, of course, you know, her moms and stuff like that, but it's different when you have kids. Your whole mindset changes. And then 40, because when I hit 40, it was like, okay, this is who I am. This is what I'm doing. How can I maximize it? You know, I was already, you know, shooting with several people. I was, at the time, I was shooting with Wilhelmina. And, you know, I was accomplishing some things, and my name started growing in the industry. And that was like a focusing effect for me. It was like, all right, I'm 40. Is this where I want to be? Is this what I want to do? And do I see the potential to do this long term? You know, I took stock at 40. I took stock at what I'm doing with myself and said, is this what I want to be doing? Is this where I want to be? And realized that I was happy where I am, and that, you know, my focuses were true. And, you know, it was like formulating a game plan. You know, shortly after that is when, you know, I got with GEI, and it's been, you know, nothing but uphill ever since. So those were the 2 years that really made me consider, you know, who I am and what am I doing with myself, 31 and 40.
That's dope, yeah. Like I said, 21 was mine, where I definitely, like you said, not physically, because even now at 40, I don't physically feel. I still feel like I'm young. Like I still, you know what I mean? I don't feel older. But like 21, it was just like, yeah, man, I ain't got to, you know what I'm saying? It's like a lot of stuff that I was doing those things, but I had to sneak and do it. You get what I'm saying? Like I was going to the club. I was in DC clubs at 14, you know what I'm saying? 15. But
yeah,
it was always,
yeah,
is this going to work? Is this going to work? Or it's like, give me an extra $80. Give me an extra. Man, when I turned 21,
yeah,
it seemed like when I turned 21, they didn't even ask me for the ID. And I was waiting for them. Like a lot of cases, I was waiting for it. Like,
yeah,
come on, ask me. Say you want my ID. But, yeah, it was just a 21 joint, though. But, yeah, that's good to hear, man.
You had that milk on your breath no more. That's all. They smell that milk on your breath at 20. As soon as you turn 21, it go away.
Yeah, man.
Yeah,
you know, 21 for me was a little bit different because 21, I was doing world tours. I was a dancer at that time. I was doing world tours with Kid and Play and MC Light. So by the time I was 21, I was making, you know, pretty big money. And I had already seen the world. So I knew, you know, my scope, my vision was already clear at 21. I knew that the world was a big place. And I knew the effect that our culture has on the world. Because, you know, I'll never forget, I did Japan with Light. And, like, the knowledge that they had of hip-hop back then, I mean, they knew every word to every song. They knew the culture. It was like being in Brooklyn or in Harlem, the way they was hooded out. It was like, wow, you know? So it gave me a perspective that the world is a big place and that we affect the world, you know, and we're seen differently across the world than we're seen here in America. You know, just in terms of they look at us with reverence because, you know, everything that we're able to produce, everything that we progenit, you know, we're the progenitors of, that the whole world was copying and idolizing. You know, they were idolizing us. Mm-hmm. It was crazy, you know. And I learned quick that, you know, that confidence, that pride of being black, you know, really came during those formative years. Like, I would say from, like, 17 to 23 when I was really doing, you know, the hip-hop scene. That really got me to see that, you know, we ain't no joke. Like we big out here, you know. So it was like, you know, that's why, like, when I see artists like K-Nell, like you know, my pride level goes up another notch. You know what I'm saying? Because the power of what you carry in your voice, bro, the power of what you carry in your throat is so powerful. And that's why I always big you up. That's why I'm always talking about you. Because that's a platform that, you know, a lot of artists is forgetting that it's power. It's not just trying to make money or trying to get girls and all that crap. It's power.
Right,
power
right.
In that voice. You know what I'm saying? So that's why I'm always complimenting you, bro. So that's what's up.
No doubt.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, hip-hop was different back then.
I wanted to kind of flip the show tonight. The last 2 weeks, and I did a couple. I did another show, and we was, you know, talking about the riots and stuff. Kind of want to get on, like, a, you know, the next step with this show. Like, what's the next step? What are things that we can start putting into motion? Without not giving too much of the secrets, but just, you know, in general as a people, like, day to day, like, what are some of the things that we can start working on to piggyback off of the attention we got from, you know, the young, you know, the kid, but everybody, like, it was all ages out there that was protesting, you know what I mean? So it's like, you know, we protest, what has it been, 8 days now? 7 to 8 days,
yeah.
I think?
And the numbers keep growing. No, they're going to have foot on neck for a minute, though. I don't think it's I think it's at that tipping point, so the numbers continue to grow. Me personally, I just always, I think the first thing, the type of person that I am, the first thing I did was take personal accountability and say, okay, what's immediately at my disposal to be able to be of some assistance in any way possible. For me, the point that I feel strongest about is the education. So I feel like most of us are either uninformed or misinformed. And so I wanted to, because my passion, one of my passions is conveying information and teaching and exchanging information. Me personally, I figured that's where I could start. I didn't really know how I was going to do it, but I knew that's what I wanted to do, and I started putting my energy in that direction. So one thing that I came off, I had a gift that kind of fell in my lap, per se, or as fate would have it. It was the result of perfect timing and just that declaration of me wanting to educate. One of my homies who, you know, we don't talk all the time. He hit me up every blue moon. I hit him up every blue moon. But he just reached out and said, man, I got something for you. And he sent me a package of about 100 pieces of literature. Mostly Afrocentric literature, but a little bit of everything. And I just had the idea, I know around October of last year, I had the idea to do the book club. And I didn't really execute it to its completion because I started working on the album. A lot of things came into play. But I felt it was perfect timing and now. So, you know, I just made a post on my social media outlet, reached out to my friends and just told them, you know, I got books and I'm interested in sharing. And if you're interested, just message me your email. So I sent out the books to a lot of people. And what I'm going to start doing is every Sunday night, pretty much after I conclude here, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to pick a book of the 100 that I sent out, and I'm going to begin to read it on Facebook Live. I know a lot of people don't like reading. A lot of people don't really have the patience to sit still and read. I get it. A lot of people, it's just not a desire. But I figured if I could, my goal is to read the book to all who want to tune in on Facebook Live on Sunday and Wednesday have an open discussion, have an open forum about what we're reading. So I'll do a live reading once a week, and then on Wednesday, I'll have a live discussion and begin to educate on different areas to raise the collective consciousness and to raise the awareness even more and empower that awareness with information. So that's one of the things that I'm doing immediately. And other than that, of course, I hooked up with the big homie Kevin Warren. He and I talk consistently, and you know, it's a lot of things, great things that he's doing in the Northern Florida area that he wants me to be a part of. So over the next couple of months, I'm making plans now to just take it up a notch. Again, still in the capacity of just exchanging information and educating, but I'll be working with 15 to 23 year olds in Northern Florida with him. So that's two things that I'm doing immediately that I feel I could use my influence and my perspective to do. So, you know, that's something that I decided on among the millions of other things that's going to take place. That's where I started. That's where I'm starting to build that platform now.
Yeah, that's dope.
Nice.
What's some of the things you think? What's some of the things you got, Jonathan?
Well, I like getting those answers because it kind of goes in line with what where I'm at. I mean, you know, the rebellion and the revolution we've been, you know, witnessing is all external. It has to be followed up internally. We have to look at ourselves as a people, as a culture, as a community, and reestablish some things. You know, I sent you and the wife a picture, and I said in it that, you know, the black family is the basis of our power. You know, we have to reestablish that. We have to reestablish the relationship between the black woman and the black man. We have to continue to push black men as protectors of black women instead of, you know, users or downing them. We have to be their protectors. I'm heavily involved with the Morehouse College Alumni Association, you know, and we've been having meetings and discussions as Morehouse men about how we're going to speak and how we're going to, well, what we're going to push as, you know, a historically black male college, you know, that has a level of responsibility. You know, we've always been taught, you know, at Morehouse that, you know, there's a responsibility being a black man, you know, and where's our responsibility then? You know, and in that process to identify and to cultivate our next generations of leaders, you know, who are our leaders, you know, what are they saying? Where are they located? You know, what kind of communication exists? I listened to an interview with the mayor of St. Paul, Minnesota, you know, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Twin Cities. St. Paul's mayor is a black man. And I listened to him, and he had a powerful voice discussing, you know, the revolution. And he has an interesting perspective, being a mayor who is over a police force, but at the same time being a black man from Minneapolis. So his perspective and his views were very powerful to hear. You know, I also listened to the mayor of Rochester, New York, a black woman, and she also had a powerful perspective, you know, on where we need to go from here, you know. And I think that discussion leads to new ideas. And I would love to see, you know, a broader base of discussion, not just, you know, talk within, like, Sharpton's National Action Network, which is fine, but we have to get back to grassroots community organizing and true discussion about what we want as a people, because wherever we want, we're going to have to create ourselves. We have to continue to search out black businesses and, you know, cultivate our own communities. And then finally, we have to as much as people are anti-government and all that, that's cool. But this country is still a system of laws, and we have to put things in place where the laws are changed, because the laws that we have now, the laws that we suffer under, were never created for us. So there has to be a new set of laws that is created with us in mind, you know, to continue our movement. So I don't think that the, you know, protests should stop, because this is a revolution. And I see that, you know, on the East Coast, it may have slowed down a little bit, but then I see the West Coast them blowing up, you know what I mean? And I see other countries blowing up. So we have the attention now, but we have to back it up. And we have to back it up with knowledge, understanding, and a solid, concise movement of black power.
Yeah. I agree with both of y'all, you know what I mean, on the things y'all were saying. I do. I think that right now that everybody's willingness to learn is crazy. Like, everybody just want the information, right? But we have to do, and this, I said this on Mr. Stanton's show. I said we have to do a better job as to, you know, putting out what we're putting out. Because a lot of times people just posting stuff, and it's not facts. You get what I'm saying? So people taking this and thinking it's that, taking this. For instance, just an example, Trump with the Bible. I mean, not Trump with the Bible, Hitler with the Bible. That was an edited picture. You know what I'm saying? That's not even a real picture. Like, he didn't have the Bible in his hand. But when you do that and then they find out it's a false thing, you really, that really helped his base. You get what I'm saying? It's like, look how far they would go to try to make me look bad. So I'm like, my whole thing is now is I'm trying to research every single thing I post. I want to make sure that it's, you know, as close to 100 as possible. And I think that that's something that we should be preaching, all of us on social media. Like, if you don't know, just hit somebody that might know before you post it. You know what I mean? Hit somebody you might know, because spreading false information is just as dangerous. Especially like right at a time like this, when everybody is so willing to learn and want to learn. And like I said, I tell Tika all the time, I'm like, man, I just don't want us to lose this momentum. You know what I'm saying? I just want us to, because it's in every conversation. People that I didn't think that will be paying attention, I'm having these conversations with. And everybody thing is like, okay, what's the next step? Like, okay, you know, what can I do? Or what do you have planned? Or you got something planned for us? Or do they got something planned for us? So I know on our end, I just want to keep with these platforms. I want to bring more people like minded together. You know what I'm saying? I want really to expand these platforms with the magazines, the TV, with the radio. I want to bring on a lot more people, a lot more. That show that we did Friday morning, man, it was dope. It was all ages. It was from 22 on up to 60. You know what I'm saying? It was a super dope show, man. And I definitely was motivated after that. Like, yo, we gotta keep doing this. This can't be the only time we do it. Like, we gotta keep this going as black men. And of course, definitely, you know, just putting something in place for us to protect our women better. Cause that thing you sent me, Jonathan, set me off. I'm not lying. Like, I never watched the Sandra Bland whole play out of it. I never watched the video.
Oh yeah, bro.
I never watched it. So
what you saw, the Say Her Name documentary?
No, Jonathan sent me something. It was like a 5 minute. Was it 5 minutes? Was it like 4 minutes or something?
I sent him Sandra's talk show. You know, she had her own talk show going, and she was just beating him over the head with truth. That's why they got her. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, and a lot of people don't know because, you know, it was a local thing, you know what I'm saying? But
right.
I learned because last year, at, you know, GEI, you know, we did a fashion show in Texas in October. I went back in November. And when I went back, I went to Prairie View A&M's homecoming.
Right.
And Sandra Bland, you know, is in a, you know, she went to Prairie View, and she actually worked on Prairie View, at Prairie View. And the road down to the school is the same road that, you know, she got arrested on. And I went down that road, and it just hit me. Like, it was just, it hit different going down that street, bro, because I could see it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I could see the exact spot where they stopped her, and I could see the factors around it. So it got me to start looking into her more, and I started asking people at Prairie View. And I ran into the person who runs the radio show and was like, yo, this is what she was about. Bang, 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 bang. And it just opened my eyes, you know what I'm saying? So I had to share with Tone of what she was really speaking about. And if you heard her talk, then you know why they killed her in that precinct. Because she was in there on her, she was, you know, her voice was in silence, even in the precinct. They had to get, they had to choke her out. You know what I mean? So that's why I was sharing with Tone. That's a strong black woman.
Even, definitely. When you, they did a, the documentary on her is good. The documentary is, it's called Say Her Name.
Yeah.
I know it's available. I got to find exactly where it's available at. I think I watched it on Netflix, but you know how they change stuff around. But, yeah, when they did a great job of depicting that very aspect of her, like the power, the valor, the grace of how she, you know what I mean, carried herself. You know, she was really for the people. She was really a very strong voice that they were able to silence, for lack of a better word. And I don't even want to say that because her legacy lives on, but her presence was so necessary, especially even for what's going on now. Also, another one that will shake you to your core is Recy Taylor. Recy Taylor was a long time ago. This was during the segregation era. But if you just look up the story of Recy Taylor, that one moved me the most in watching it. That documentary, I think, is on Starz, actually. It's on Starz or HBO. But when I watched the documentary on Recy Taylor, by the time it finished, I was like, yo, oh yeah, the absolute number one priority above all is protecting black women, because this is not a new phenomenon. Like, just as long as black men has been going through the shit that they've been going through, black women been right there taking it on the chin and going through some horrendous shit. So, yeah, I definitely encourage y'all. But make sure your mind and spirit is right, because, again, it's in the times of segregation, so it gets ugly. But the story of Recy Taylor is one that'll definitely shake you to your core.
Yeah, and for people listening that are interested, I'm sorry, Tone, for people that are listening are interested, Say Her Name, the Sandra Bland story, it was an HBO original, so it's on the HBO, like if you have the HBO subscription, but it's also on Hulu, Amazon Prime Video, and Google Play TV.
I have to check that joint out. Like I said, I just seen the clip. Just the clip. And I didn't even watch the entire thing. Like, it was just the fact, like, once they, you know, they pulled her over, that whole back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
For me, this is like, yo, come on, dog. Like, man, it's just, yo, we gotta do a better job and protecting. Like I said, we gotta create something to where as though when women are out, man, they can hit a button. And whoever close can, you know, whoever get that signal can come. You get what I'm saying? Like, it got to be something like that. Just, you know, like if a young woman is driving down the highway on 85, maybe I got the little thing in my car. She hit that thing on her phone. It hit. I get the address. I mean, I get the location or something. Whoever closer can go and do something. We need something like that, because just that whole thing, man, I was so mad. Like, I was so upset that, bro, like, it didn't even have to be like, it didn't even have to go the way that it went. Like, this, I felt like it was planned. You get what I'm saying? Like, you planned that whole hit. That was a hit.
Yeah.
And it's a woman, like, you could hear her saying it. Like, I'm a woman, like, you a coward. Like, you're doing this to a woman. When a male cop pulled you over, legally, they supposed to bring a female cop on the scene, unless they changed that law. I know when I was younger, that's how it was. Like, when a male cop was there.
Let me drop this on you. Here's the crazy part with Sandra Bland. There was a female cop present, but she was present to observe. It was the white cop, the male. There was a female present, and she observed. The cop literally made her strip down on the sidewalk and then tackled her to the ground and body searched her and snatched her out of the car, snatched her out of the car because she had refused to, you know, show him her ID because she kept asking him, am I being detained? And what am I being detained for? You know what I'm saying? So they snatched her out of the car.
Go ahead, John.
So he snatched her out of the car because, you know, pulled her out of the driver's side and took her off to the sidewalk, off the view of the camera. And they strip searched her. That dude strip searched her. There was a female present. You can hear her voice because she was saying to the female, you know, basically, you gonna let him do this? And the female was talking, telling her, stay calm, ma'am, stay calm. And no, they saying calm. You strip searching me out in the street, and then arrested her.
Yeah, I think it should be. I'm gonna look into this probably writing up something for, you know, when if male or female, you know what I'm saying. If you by yourself, you should be able to drive until you see some people. You know what I mean? Like, that's just where we at right now. I know they got the little thing. If it's dark, they let you go into, you know, you can pull into a lighted spot. But it's something got to change, bro, because some like the law's got to change because that's just crazy, man. There's no way you should get pulled over like that and taken out. You know what I'm saying? With nobody knowing. You know, thankfully he did leave. I mean, he left his camera on just enough for us to see him take her out the car. Because if that wasn't on, then we wouldn't know nothing about it. They probably would have said she just hung herself or something. You know what I'm saying? So he definitely
disabled the camera. Yeah, they disabled the camera in her jail cell, bro. There's so much behind that, man. Like you know, when you really start researching that, it's so deep what they did.
Did the cop ever get suspended or fired or anything?
No.
Absolutely not.
No, we're talking about Prairie View, Texas.
Yeah. You gotta remember, yo, they still I think in the state of Texas, the law is still illegal, I think, by law, and I'll double-check to be sure as we spoke about vetting information. But I think they still have the law on the books, granted, be it's probably obsolete, but a black man can't even ride a horse in Texas, like, by law.
That's correct.
They got laws on the books that old, bro. Not that it's enforced, but the fact that it's still present. Just let
that
you know it's
present,
a whole different...
And that's the thing.
Yeah.
This is where we got to start. This is where we got to start, like, in these spots. Because in those type of spots, like in these rural spots, they do walk with their chest poked out because the laws back them. And it's black people, but it's not a lot of black people. It's kind of hard to be like that in the city. You know what I mean? They get away with stuff in the city, too, but the city is just a little different than out where Arbery was, you know, out in, you know, in the country parts of Georgia and Texas and Mississippi and Alabama. So, excuse me. We gotta revisit all this stuff, man. It's like a clean 2020 is like a clean slate. Like we gotta rewrite all these laws. I literally just watched the lynching thing, like about they was fussing about that bill, like. How is that still,
exactly.
Like, come on, man. You know what I'm saying? How disrespectful is it? Like, this is the Like, this is how comfortable we made y'all. You know what I'm saying? We made y'all that comfortable that that bill stayed all these years.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah,
so
it's been
22
years.
Man.
That bill was introduced 22 years ago, and it's to the point now where it got passed in the House of Representatives 492-4. It's being filibustered right now in the Senate by one Republican senator from Kentucky who feels that the law is too ambiguous, that it doesn't give a deep enough description of what lynching is. And he feels that, you know, that someone can get stopped on anything and they can, you know, say, oh, it's lynching. And Senator Cory Booker, you know, got into a big, you know, disagreement with this gentleman, you know, on the Senate floor, and it's just become like this crazy thing. But it's going to get passed. But it's just the fact that we're still doing this in 2020. It's kind of crazy, bro. It's like, you know, that one person. I mean, every other senator has agreed to this, except for that one person, and it's filibustering the whole thing, holding it up. And the fact that this is even a discussion in 2020 is absolutely crazy.
It is. Now, before we, because we got about, 20 minutes left, I definitely want to switch the subject up a little bit. I know we touched on this a little bit, but we never got into it because it was at the end of one show, then the following week it kind of, you know, the whole this thing happened. But I was actually just you know, doing some research and watching the young basketball player Williams. He a freshman in high school, and he made a post about going to HBCU. You know, and I hope you're serious about it. Reading his Instagram post. You know, for him being that young, and the words that he spoke in that, you know, he wrote in that post was powerful. And how big of a game changer is the number one point guard as a freshman, his class as a freshman, saying, you know, he's thinking, you know, he's almost certain that he's going to a HBCU. How big of a game changer is that? Well,
it's definitely a good start. It's definitely a good start because, as we know, you know, the it's a $5 to $6 billion profit in NCAA sports annually every year. That's the profit. That's not gross. That's net. You know what I mean? Standing that type of power is generated by the, of course, athleticism of predominantly black sports in basketball and football and so forth. It's a powerful platform, and I think if more students follow suit, it'll definitely shift the tide. People always have this misconception, well, the smaller schools, they're underfunded, they don't have the exposure, they don't have the TV contracts. I'm like, that's because all the top athletes is going to these PWIs. They're going to predominantly white institutes. If all of the top athletes started to go into HBCUs, now all of a sudden those ABC, NBC, those TV contracts, they're not going to major schools no more. They're not going to the SEC no more. Those contracts is going to go to the MEAC. You know what I mean? It's going to go where the HBCUs are because that's where the talent is. And subsequently, those schools will no longer be underfunded because the ticket sales and the media exposure and those deals, that money is divided amongst the schools. So, again, that's a resource. So it's so much politics involved with it, but I think that's one of the huge areas where black people have to leverage. You look at the time when in 1968, the New York City Football Classic was played between Grambling College. It wasn't even a state university yet. It was Grambling College versus Morgan State. They sold out the Yankee Stadium in no time. And it was so much controversy surrounding it because it was like, you know, these are two HBCUs that just sold out Yankee Stadium in a day. And so, you know, given it was 1968, it was a lot of scrutiny. But when you look at everything that surrounded the year, everything that was going on during that time, whether it's Martin Luther King dying, all of that, you know what I mean, it took place. It was the perfect setting. And this was a game played at the highest level between, you know, two highly touted black coaches of both institutions. And ultimately, the game was decided by a single play on fourth and goal. And that game alone produced, because it was, of course, pre-integration of sports, but that game alone produced Hall of Fame players in the NFL. You know what I mean? And those are products of HBCUs. So I feel like that sense of pride, that's one of the stories that I want to tell, too, and I want to tell. Because that type of, to renew that sense of pride in our HBCUs, I think that'll go a long way to changing the narrative and getting more people excited and proud to attend HBCUs and not just to party. You know what I mean? Too often that stigma is associated with HBCUs. Well, you know you're going to have a good time there. No, but it's so many brilliant minds and scholars that's going to be created by HBCUs. So I support it, and I like it 1,000%.
Yeah. What you think, John?
Well, so this is layered. You know, I'm a graduate of an HBCU, so there's a lot of things that I have a perspective on. But first, let me say that the federal government started defunding HBCUs in the 80s. And a lot of these great institutions didn't survive. Immediately come to my head, Morris Brown. You know, Morris Brown College, you know, lost their accreditation and had to close their doors. And one of the things that really started taking money away from us was our great black athletes going to these what they call power conferences that were established because of the influx of black talent. Conferences as we know it in college sports started with football, and it started when white schools, particularly in the South, started recruiting black players. The concept of it opened up in 1966 when Texas Western, with an all-black starting five, beat reigning national champion Kentucky for the NCAA championship. That opened up the concept of black players, you know, being champions, because Kentucky was considered a powerhouse that couldn't be beat. Actually, Pat Riley was on that team. And they lost to this all-black tiny school for the championship. After that, they started recruiting in earnest black players, promising them, you know, exposure to the pros and contracts and shoe deals and all this stuff. And in the 70s, they started pushing these power conferences. We are the reason why there are power conferences in the first place. But what we were paying attention to was, as the power conferences and the white schools started getting bigger like that, the black schools started falling behind. We used to have our own power conferences. The SWAC was the original power conference with Grambling.
Yep.
Game that you're talking about in Yankee Stadium, you know, they have a classic every year, Grambling versus Walcom.
Every year.
And, every year. And then you had FAMU that had a powerful team. You had Tuskegee, which was, like, legendary in the South for their powerful teams. Texas Southern in Houston, power team. Prairie View, you know, right outside of Houston.
Yeah.
So these schools are struggling. And somehow the conversation kind of got missed here. But our historically black colleges and universities are struggling. You have schools like Howard, Morehouse, Spelman, whose endowments and alumni associations are big enough to survive.
Right. Exactly.
We give back to our institutions. But most of our colleges are small. Talladega College in Alabama, Benedict College, you know, Claflin University, South Carolina State, you know, North Carolina A&T University. These schools need these dollars. And where do we get our dollars from? Sports. Sports is big money. So if we start getting our talent back in our schools, the money will follow. And even in even on the white institution level, you're starting to see where the big name schools are starting to level out talent wise with the smaller colleges. You're starting to see smaller universities, you know, in the Final Four. Butler, you know, who almost beat Duke, like, you know, they lost by a point to Mighty Duke and all that stuff. So all we have to do is start sending our children to our own, which goes back to, you know, again, planning and supporting our own community, and the money will follow. Because, you know, what they don't talk about is how many black athletes went to the pros from black colleges all throughout the 60s and the 70s. Some of the, you know, some of the most known names of our history in basketball and stuff and in football came from black college. Doug Williams, the first black quarterback to win the Super Bowl, black college. Grambling. He's the coach of Grambling now. You know what I'm saying? So, like, I think that's a very not monumental thing if he does go to a black school, and I hope it's Morehouse. I think if more parents actually struck the conversation, then why not? You know, and let's make these conferences, you know, the, you know, SAIC and the SWAC and, the NEAC, the MEAC, you know, with Howard and them, you know, let's make these what they used to be and start keeping the money where it's supposed to be. Not only that, I think that as black institutions and as black conferences, I'm sorry, it's my last point, but, you know, right now the NCAA states that, you know, as an amateur, you can't make a dime. And we all know about the probe going on right now with Zion Williamson. You know, even though he's now in the pros playing for New Orleans, there's a probe because they said that he received improper benefits while he was at Duke. I think that our black institutions should lead the charge to pass legislation to pay these athletes, because these athletes count for billions of dollars with a B, like K-Nell said, you know. And I think more children would support our black institutions if we had some radical legislation, you know, for them.
Yeah. I think it should have been happening. Especially the kids that know, like say like Zion. Zion could have went to Howard and played three games. He was going to the NBA. Some of these kids are automatically going to the NBA. Like, it's not even a question. It's just when they're going to get drafted. Where, you know, one, two, three, or four. Like, we need a kid like that to make that jump. You know what I mean? We need a kid like that. Like, Zion go to Howard, it changed the landscape. The kid's going to follow. It can't just be, you know, I mean, of course, we want all our kids to go to the HBCUs, but to make a, like, change as far as money, TV, and advertising dollars and stuff that these schools can not only put into sports but put into other parts,
exactly.
It has to be a
smallest part. The sports is the smallest part. Just think. If a school got $10 million or $20 million because of what the athletics did, the athletics is one thing. They're gonna redistribute that money to other departments that need resources for research, for programs and curriculums and things like that. They'll be able to grow because if they have a curriculum that's available, that's the difference between you going to a HBCU who has it versus in the past they didn't. Because I know people
I graduated with people that didn't go to a HBCU only because they didn't have the major. So it's not, you respect that. You know what I mean? You know what you want to do with your life, so you make that, you know, you make that sacrifice. But if a HBCU had their major, they definitely would have went to it. But none of the local ones, none of the state HBCUs had the major. So stuff like that play into it as well. But when you have the funding, like you mentioned, so when you have the funding that's kind of created and backed by the resources that the athletics could bring, the exposure, the contracts and things like that it could bring, then those resources could be redistributed so that the school can grow all across the board.
Yeah, because I heard, you know, some people say it's $150 million. Some people say it's $300 million. This is the number. Let's just say at the very least it's $150 million. This is the number that they said Allen Iverson made Georgetown playing for those 2 years at Georgetown. $150 million total.
Right.
That's like ticket sales, jerseys, $150 million. Do you know what that would do to, you know, in North Carolina A&T or Cook? Gracious, man, like crazy.
Yep.
Carmelo Anthony accounted for $150 million in 1 year at Syracuse when they won the national championship, and he played at Oak Hill Academy, and Howard was in the conversation. But again, you know, the promise of the big money and stuff like that, you know, he wound up going to Syracuse. Bayham came down there and put the right things in their ear. But I remember at Morehouse, we played, you know, three games on a schedule every year against Division I schools. You know, every year we played Georgia Tech, obviously right there in Atlanta. We played Alabama, you know, and then a third school, you know, they would pick one or whatever. And it was always us going to their gym, you know. And we would get slaughtered, you know. And I remember my junior year, you know, we had asked, like, you know, why is it always on the schedule like that? Why we always got to go to their house and yada, yada, yada. We found out that those three games made up for 11% of the budget. 11% of the school budget was in those three games. That's how much money we were getting to go play at those schools. And none of those schools were going to come play at us. You know, but we were going to them. It was kind of like, you know, how the big schools, you know, they schedule these little schools for a tune-up and stuff, you know, like Morehouse College versus Kentucky, you know. Like, are you serious with the recruiting they have and stuff? You know, so, you know, that's what we have to do, you know, black colleges. We have to, you know, do the scrap things, you know, to survive. And if our athletes just supported our schools, that whole landscape would change, bro.
Yeah, you got to sell it, too. We got to take more pride in that HBCUs. And like Nell said, it's not about just coming to party. You know what I'm saying? Because it's some great professors and great people that came from these colleges. But a lot of kids don't even know it. Like, a lot of kids don't know that, you know, Bill Cosby, Martin Luther King. Like, a lot of great guys came from these schools because it's really not preached like that. You know what I mean? So I think if we take a little bit more pride in the schools, and we can just, you know, if we can get, like I said, this kid could be a game changer, man, for the future, because they already saying, like, as long as he stay on the right track, he's going number one. Like LeBron, all of NBA, James Harden, they be at his games now. He only in ninth grade. Nicky Williams, look him up. You know what I'm saying? And he really just coasting, like.
Yeah.
Those kids he's playing against, he's so much, he's so advanced in them. It's a joke, you know what I'm saying? But man, him thinking about that is awesome, yo, because he can definitely change the landscape. Like I said, if he go, I'm pretty sure a couple more follows and a couple more follow in the next 20, 30 years, that's what the kids would be doing. And now, you talking now when Morehouse play Kentucky is a different story. You get what I'm saying? It's not that deal. Like for instance, like I found this out too, Jonathan. the same thing you found out. Because I'm like, why are we always playing these sorry teams? But somebody told me that the schools that play Alabama, like them first three games, that's how they school maintain. They get like $7 or $8 million to play Alabama, knowing they're gonna get killed by like 50.
Yeah.
Like Appalachian State.
Sometimes those bigger schools also pick those smaller schools for their homecoming game for a guaranteed victory, because you don't want to lose a homecoming.
But hey, Michigan made a big mistake.
Let me tell you something.
Appalachian State.
They beat Michigan that one year.
Let me tell you something
because we played Georgia Tech every year for their, you know, we played them for their homecoming, and they won by 5, but it homecoming didn't feel like home. You heard Lamar, you know, y'all in Atlanta, you know, George Morehouse and Georgia Tech ain't but a hop, skip, and a jump. We damn near walk over there, you know what I'm saying? So we damn near whoop their ass, trust me, you know what I mean? So, because the talent is the talent. And because of the way the AAU systems are set up, these are guys that he was playing with over the summer anyway. These guys we were playing ball with. You know, we was balling with guys from Georgia Tech. We knew them. So we knew how they play, you know what I'm saying? And it's the same thing now. That's why these smaller schools are on par. Look at John Morant and Murray State. You know, they was banging them. You know what I mean? Nobody wanted to play Murray State because of that, you know? The kid from Georgia State, remember his father was coaching a team, little light-skinned kid? You know,
and
all the teams they beat. You know what I'm saying? So, like, you know, the talent is there. It's not a question of talent. It really isn't. It's part of the whole systemic racism, to be honest with you. You know, we talk about systemic racism and how we get treated by police and businesses and stuff, but don't forget about systemic racism in education. And the way you keep people from being uneducated is you defund their education.
Of course.
You know, shitty facilities, shitty labs, and, you know, stuff like that. Like, we teach all the courses that all the big schools teach.
But let's keep it real, though, Jonathan. Us three on this phone know why, you know, a Cam Newton or a Zion or whoever go to these same 5 schools. They're getting paid. They're
of
getting
course.
Money. You know what I'm saying? If they're not getting
of
paid,
course.
You know, per se, they mother or father getting taken care of. You know what I mean? So, or family members.
Of course.
So that's the difference between, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. That's the difference between sometimes them going to a HBCU who barely got the funds to run the college and going to a Duke where they could be like, listen, I'm going to give your mother $100,000 if you come here. You know what I mean? What's the old movie we used to watch back in the day with Shaq, Penny, and all them.
Yeah.
It was, I can't think of the name, Blue Chips. They showed you how they do it.
Yeah.
Oh, I need a new lawnmower. I need a new house. You know what I mean?
Right.
They get the boosters to go and do. Yeah, man, so these kids not just going to Duke because it's a great school and they want to go there. Them guys getting paid, man. And they know they only got to be there for 1 year, and they in the league. Just don't get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically
It's even deeper than that. My cousin is Kenny Anderson. He played at Georgia Tech and went to the Nets. He was the number 3 pick in the draft. When he was being recruited, one of the things that Kremens told them, because Bobby Kremens was the coach at Georgia Tech at the time, things Kremens told him is Georgia Tech had a shoe deal. You know, most of these schools have shoe deals. You know, like you'll see all the players wearing, you know, Adidas or Nike or whatever. And the shoe company will have an agreement with the parent that as soon as that kid leaves school, here's your deal. So I'm going to Georgia Tech, not necessarily because, you know, Kremens promised me this, that, and the third, but at the end of 2 years with Georgia Tech, when I go pro, I have $100 million shoe deal waiting on me. Penny Hardaway had that. You know, Kyrie Irving had that. you know, Kyrie at Duke. So that's the leverage that they pull. It's not just the big schools in the NCAA. It's the corporations that are funding, that are working with these schools, you know, like Nike and Adidas and, you know, Spalding, you know, and all that. So it's that's why I think that, you know, for us black schools, you know, we need to do something radical, bro. Like, you know, we don't really need to be, like, part of the NCAA, like, in my opinion. That's just me. But the NCAA ain't do nothing for us anyway, as far as I'm concerned. You know, we have our own associations, you know. We even have our own accreditations. So we don't need the NCAA. You know, we need to band together, start our own governing body like that, and offer these kids some type of stipend, some type of salary. And I think these kids will come. Because I think college football players ought to be paid anyway.
I think they don't do that right now because, like, again, our schools are struggling because you don't have that star. Like, this outside of Stanford, because a lot of the, you know, lawyers and big time Stanford, Oregon, and schools like that, they got a lot of, like, billionaires that came from them schools. So they, whether the sports do good or not, they make sure the school is straight. USC, they make
right,
sure the school is straight.
Ohio State.
Ohio State.
What you say,
but
now?
It's enough black money. Well, I can't. No, I was just saying the alumni endowments be crazy because the alumni give, you know, they donate. Because you got to think of somebody like Diddy, for example. I'll use a tangible just to create real perspective. When I was working in the car business, one of the top salespeople, of course, you know, I would chop it up with him. This man told me he paid $26,000 in taxes every quarter just so he don't owe at the end of the year, right? That was just how he broke his finances down. Now, that's just selling cars. So he was making roughly about $250,000 in the car business a year, right? That's what he had to donate in the car business. So of $250,000, $80,000 of that, let's just say, just under $100,000, he had to pay for taxes. Now, I say that to say, think of somebody like Diddy. How much money do he have to pay on his earnings for a year? How much taxes? So making those type of sizable donations to the endowments is a win-win. So he could look out for Howard University, although he didn't graduate. He got an honorary, you know what I mean, degree, but he attended. But that ain't nothing but a tax write-off for him. Not saying that that's his motive, but think of these predominantly white institutions. They got multiple Diddies that's alumni. That's just a tax write-off to the endowment. So just that alone helps keep the campus stimulated. And I feel like now we're coming to a time where at this pinnacle, I'm not even going to say pinnacle, but as we see the amount of black athletes that we have and the amount of them that's becoming more and more socially aware outwardly, you know, because before it was such fear of repercussion that a lot of them, of course, they wanted to be vocal, but look what they did to Kaepernick. So it's like now I'm going to risk the lifestyle that I've created for myself to make a statement. I ain't prepared to do that. Not everybody is prepared to do that. Now that fear of repercussion is seeming like it's withering away because more and more of these athletes are being far more vocal as a result of what they did to Kaepernick. You know what I mean? And so you see athletes and entertainers speaking out and really got their pulse on what's going on. So I think as we see that, we'll see more and more involvement in raising money for the HBCUs. But, I mean, five billionaires is enough. Not to tell somebody what to do with their money, but we know five black billionaires in the United States.
And again, so let's take it right here. We got about 5 minutes. Well, we over, but we can go for a couple more minutes. Let's just do this. I'm seeing all these white, black, all these corporations donate money to racial injustice, right? What the fuck is that? Like, what's that and who run it?
So it's,
if you notice,
go, the good thing about it is I think it's public information. So all you have to do is find out exactly who are running the initiatives, and it'll tell you. It's pretty, from the outside looking in, it does seem pretty ambiguous. It's like, okay, I'm donating $100 million to racial equality. Okay, how what does that consist of? I think when you dig a little deeper, it just requires research. They're not going to say it's these five charities or these five institutions that I'm donating to. But if you read the fine print, I'm sure it's outlined somewhere, because I'm pretty certain that type of information is public. But I get what you're saying. I do understand.
Yeah, because I typed it in, but of course I don't know the actual charity behind it. Like, that's just the name. Like, everybody's using this one tag. Like, every corporation I'm talking about, McDonald's, Michael Jordan, everybody, Drake, everybody's saying this one thing. So it's like, okay, what is this and where is this money going? Because is it really gonna trickle down to the communities to where it needs to go? Is this money gonna go to where it needs to go? No, that was my whole the setup. Like, okay, go ahead, give this money to this place, tax write off, whatever the case it may be. Nobody's gonna really research this, what they saying it is, and that's it. I think if Michael Jordan could give $100 million to racial injustice, he could give $100 million, or not even that much. He could give $10 million, because he said he'd be giving $100 million for 10 years. I mean, spread out, $10 million a year. So I'm thinking, like, okay, what if you would have gave $10 million to each one of the black colleges? Just you alone would help out so many kids.
Right.
But I mean, this is definitely going to be another topic. But you know, I was talking to my father, and I told him, I said, you know, we don't have we're not in that bracket, right? We're not in that $100 million, $200 million, $300 million bracket. It's something about making that money like that. I don't know, because everybody can't turn their back on the community. You can't tell me that a lot of these guys don't want to do the right thing as far as community and college and whatever, just helping black people, period. You know what I mean? I just don't want to believe that many people are that selfish. I feel like it's something over their head, or it's like once you hit a bracket, there's a different type of something to it, because there's no way at this point in 2020, forget billionaires, with the amount of millionaires we got, you got to think, it's kids, team 17, worth $10, $15 million, $20 million. Like, it's so much black wealth right now. Like, these things shouldn't even be, like, the schools not having AC, kids not being able to eat, and or it shouldn't even be a problem. We shouldn't even be talking about this.
Right.
Colleges having to get money from Bill Gates because I think it was Morehouse. You know, got money from Bill Gates. $23 million because it was about to close. Come on, dog. Like, that don't make no sense.
Yeah.
Jermaine Dupri or one of them in the city could have did that.
Mm-hmm. Well, LeBron James gets it. And his solution was, I'll start my own. He made his own school, you know. And
because
what happens is,
it's still chartered, but it is. I don't want to say, but it's chartered. I don't want to minimize the power and impact, because what him and Jalen Rose doing is important. It's super important. But when you have a chartered school, you're only allowed per se to teach the curriculum in line with what the local curriculum is on. So, yeah, it's a lot of things that you can do to create an environment more conducive to the success of the students on one end, but on the other end, you're still only regurgitating and giving them the information that isn't necessarily as beneficial. But it's better than its alternative. That's why I'm not speaking from a point of it being problematic. I'm just saying that we have to also take steps of even going beyond a chartered school and creating our own private institutions separate from what they because as long as they can regulate the curriculum, they can control the information that we're able to give to our students and give to our children.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing that, you know, Malcolm X said that was very powerful. You allow your enemy to educate your kids, you've already lost. You know what I mean? So I think it's important we keep that in mind. But I'm sorry, I just wanted to make that point known because I think what they're doing is excellent. It's great. And I think that's step one. I think the next step is then branching from there to work on a curriculum that's in line with the values that best serves us as a community.
And honestly, I think what LeBron, real quick, John, I'm going to let you get. With LeBron, he's smart enough. I think that was chess. If I come straight out and do it, it's going to get backlash. You get what I'm saying?
Right.
He been right there on with every – listen, outside of Muhammad Ali, you know, we can get into the Michael Jordan, the Kobe's and all that.
Yeah.
Bro, LeBron might be almost past Muhammad Ali. The only thing the difference between Muhammad Ali and LeBron was Muhammad Ali was a little bit more outgoing, like in the crowd with it, on TV shows with
it.
LeBron, you know, he's more subtle, a little bit more subtle, but he does the same thing, man. That kid, man, that young man, yo, like, I don't think people appreciate him like they should. You know what I'm saying? Like they should. He be dead on with every single thing, bro. He don't hold his tongue. He be on it. And people give him hell, and I don't know, and it's crazy that they look over that. Because we got celebrities like Mayweather, who is one of the best boxers ever, but you lack social knowledge. Like, you just don't have no type of connection or anything with what's going on. And in some cases, you know, you don't care. And it's crazy because you come from that. But go ahead, Jonathan. I ain't mean to cut you off.
I think they're getting there. Like, first, like, full disclosure, as a basketball fan, I don't like LeBron James. I'm a Golden State Warriors fan. I can never like LeBron James, right? But as a human being, LeBron James is the most influential black athlete in our history.
Past
Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
Past Jim Brown. Past Jackie Robinson. Because of the breadth and the width of his platform and what he's doing with it, I honestly feel he has surpassed these all-time greats.
I understand where both of y'all coming from, but I refuse to create a hierarchy in this category because.
Well, of course. I understand that.
Great.
No, I'm with you on that.
Listen, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Jim Brown, Bill Russell, Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte, those guys single-handedly funded the civil rights movement. Not some of it, but all of it. They was getting that money from Hollywood. They was getting that money from – and that was back then. So that's why I toned to your point, to your earlier point, it's no excuse today because they wasn't making no way. They had the money that athletes and entertainers making today, but they were able to single-handedly fund the civil rights movement. So I get what y'all saying because I hold LeBron in that esteem too, but I can't create a hierarchy with this one because they was able to build that platform that he was able to put a monument on top of, and they were both equally necessary.
I would say this because I agree. I'm glad you corrected that. I'm not saying one is better than the other, right?
Right.
In my lifetime, I got to see personally every move LeBron made. I never seen what, you know, only to read what Kareem did, Harry Belafonte.
Right.
You know, I wasn't in the 50s and the 60s with Bill Russell and them. So I get the stories. I get it. What they did was super important. But for me, I watched this kid from 19 until now do what he's doing. So I feel like LeBron more a part, even though I'm older than LeBron, but I feel like he's more a part of me than – you know,
right. I got you.
Jim Brown, them because I just wasn't there. Like, I just got to hear stories and read about it. But we actually watching LeBron. And I'm pretty sure if those guys was in this era if they wasn't as old, you know, older like they are, like they would be right on the front line too. You know what I'm saying? But just yep. watching LeBron do, watching somebody do it, now I know what, how my father and them feel about those guys because they got a chance
exactly.
to watch those guys do it. So yeah, it's dope, you know. It's,
right.
It's dope, and if LeBron can do all that.
Sure.
Just him.
Right,
just imagine if he had 10, 15 people.
Yep.
Right.
And just to clarify what I was saying, I chose the word surpass. That doesn't necessarily mean greater than, but surpass, as in he took ton and it's taken it further.
True indeed.
You know what I mean? And you're supposed to. You know what I mean? You're supposed to. So I just – and the whole charter, I do think that was a chess move. Somebody got to open the door. You know what I mean? Like you got to open the door. So – and then after you open the door, you change the lock. You feel me? So I'm glad that the door has been open. And something that K-Nell said that really, you know, kind of stuck in my head, you know, how those giants funded the entire movement in the, you know, late 50s and 60s. And it
yeah.
goes back to something I had said earlier at the beginning of our show where we have to take a look inside, introspective, organize, and then move out. You know, that's the
yeah.
one thing they had in the late 50s and the late 60s, organized. You know what I'm saying? So now that we have this voice and people are looking and paying attention and all that stuff, we have to organize. And then part
mm-hmm.
of that organization can be all the stuff that we're talking about. You know, our focus on our black institutions, because black education is the key. You know what I mean? And the focus on, you know, our communities and our churches and, you know, our family, the black family, you know, our focus on educating our black men, because you know that the numbers of black men being incarcerated are just out of this world, and you know that they're going to keep trying to do that. So we have to educate our black men, you know, things of that nature, you know what I mean? So it starts with
yeah.
the organization concept, you know, and then you can achieve the things that Kay Nels has been and telling that you've been putting in the air. And I think it's possible, bro. It's not just possible. Like, now's the time, man. Now is the
no, it's
time.
It's going to happen.
I just,
it's not hoping. It's not wishing. It's doing. Like, it's going to happen. Like, it's already in. It's already changing. Like, you can see the shift. I told I was talking to my uncle them for my birthday. We had, of course, like I said, it's in every discussion. And I'm like, listen, even if the apologies are as bullshit as possible, the fact that these billionaires even feel like they gotta apologize speaks value. Whether it's sincere or not. Because back, let's just go back when we was all protesting the NFL about what Kaepernick did. Now, them billionaires didn't care about us. So what? We ain't picking them. Oh, but now is a new time. We're sorry. We
right.
wish we would have listened. Yeah, because they know we're not playing now. They're watching companies go from being powerhouses to closing the door. People not playing
right.
now. So everybody, all these billionaires trying to jump in front of it like, we sorry. Okay, that's cool. But yeah, we still shutting you down. Because like as of right now, I'm back on it. I'm not watching the NFL. I'm not buying no jerseys. I'm not doing nothing.
Right.
I'd rather for you
right.
sit. Listen, when he said he was sorry and they should have listened, that just lets me know that you knew you was wrong and you still
yep.
did it. You get what I'm saying? So I can't, yeah, I'm done with the NFL, bro. I would never watch another game again. And if it's on somebody's TV, I'm leaving the house. Like, that's where I'm at with the NFL. Like, I felt like that was the ultimate slap in the face to say, I apologize, we should have listened. Because you knew you was wrong. You knew you was wrong 4 years ago. Now, unless they give Cap a job. They give Cap a job, then I watch
yeah.
it. But they're not going to do that.
That's the first
they'll give him a
right.
seat. They'll give
that's
him a seat at the table.
That
make him
wrong. Give him a job.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
I will say this. I know we almost at the conclusion, but my phone is literally about to die, yo.
All right, go ahead. Let people know where they can find you at, yo. Let everybody know where they can
for
find
sure,
you at.
For sure. For sure. I appreciate everybody as always. You can find me everywhere under K Nels. That's KAYNELLZ. I will probably in like another hour and a half, 2 hours, around 9 o'clock, I'll be going live from Facebook. starting the first piece of literature that I'm starting with, just to let everybody know, is going to be from Dr. Amos. It's the Blueprint for Black Power. It's a lecture that he did in the early 90s. So I'm going to start. I have transcripts from that lecture, and I feel just from what I canvassed over, it's definitely very pertinent and relevant to the times. And that's Dr. Amos Wilson. The lecture is The Blueprint for Black Power. I'll start reading that live tonight. And do some time to research who Dr. Amos Wilson was. He was a theoretical psychologist. He taught psychology at several universities from 1981 to 1995 when he passed away. But he was centered in, you know, Pan-Africanist ideas and things like that. So we're going to explore a lot of the concepts and things that he was talking about. So, again, I appreciate you. Shout out to GEI Radio as always. Shout out Tone. Shout out Jonathan. That's Kate Nels, K-A-Y-N-E-L-L-Z. Good luck, gentlemen.
All right, that's a bet. Jonathan, let everybody know where they can find you at.
Hey, everybody. You can find me at J-E-Photos underscore CEO, J-E-P-H-O-T-O-S underscore CEO on all social media. You can check my website, www.je-photos.com. I'm the president of GEI, and if you go hashtag in GEI on any search media, any platform, our company will pop up. As a photographer, on June 20th here in New York City, we're doing a Black Power, Black Lives Matter power shoot, and the whole concept is blackness, you know. The looks will be like the afros and the blackness of the 60s and 70s up to the expression of Black Power now. So those that are in the NYC metro area, June 20th, you know, and I'll start posting it on the social media. That's going to be super, super dope. Shout out to Taz Paul, you know, who we worked with to put it together, and that's going to be powerful. But follow us on all social media platforms, hashtag GEI. You know, GEI Radio is a part of GEI, and our host, Tone, is the CEO. Happy birthday to you again, bro, and that's where you'll find me.
Appreciate it. That's what's up. You can find me Twitter, Instagram, GEI underscore Tone, Facebook, Tone Mitchell or Tone GEI. You can follow this show on Blog Talk Radio. Just, you know, type us in, click follow. GEI Radio on all social media platforms. And again, Juneteenth at Studio GEI, we will be opening up our doors to 10 Black-owned businesses to sell, to set up, sell, you know, get a table and sell your merch free of charge. So all you have to do is send an email to studiogeimd@gmail.com. That's studiogeimd@gmail.com. It's going to be first come, first serve. So get your email in. And that's pretty much it, man. You can catch us here every Sunday, 6 to 7. Myself, Jonathan, K-Nails, everybody enjoy the rest of your night. Peace.
Peace.